We've reached about the halfway point in Sefer Shmos. And Sefer Shmos is called Sefer HaGeula, the Book of Redemption. Now I understand why Shmos, Va'era, Bo are in the Book of Redemption, because that speaks about the redemption. I also understand why Bishalach, which speaks about the splitting of the Red Sea, is there, because they weren't really free, the Sfarno says, until the Egyptians were killed. Till then they were like slaves running away from their master. Now the masters were no longer there, and they were really free. I even understand why Yisro is in Sefer HaGeula, because the culmination of their freedom was getting the Torah. And that's why the holiday of Pesach and the holiday of Shavuos are connected with Sfiras HaOmer. But I don't understand why Mishpatim, Truma, Tetzaveh, Kisisa, Vayakel Pekudei is in the Book of Geula. Mishpatim is very similar to Parshas Kedoshim, has a lot of mitzvahs in it, could have been in Sefer Vayikra, or Bamidbar, or Devarim. And Truma, to the end, just talks about the Mishkan. I would have put that as the beginning of Vayikra, as the preface to bringing sacrifices. You have to build a Mishkan. So the building of the Mishkan should have been in Toras Kohanim, in the third book, which speaks about the laws of the Kohanim, and most of that centers around the Mishkan. So the building of the Mishkan should have been in Vayikra. Why are these parshios from this coming week's Edrach till the end of Shmos in the book of Shmos, Sefer Geula? Perhaps one way of understanding it is the following. The rabbis tell us that Ein lecha ben chorin ela misha osik batorah. Cherus al haluchos. Chorus, it's engraved on the luchos, don't read engraved, but redeemed. Freedom. Freedom is only a person who is totally immersed in Torah. Now, being immersed in Torah is a very nice thing, very praiseworthy, but call that freedom? Right? If anything, in the vernacular, we call a Jew who is not observant a freie Yid, a free Jew, because he basically is free to eat whatever he wants, free to wear what he wants, to say what he wants, to think what he wants, to dress like he wants, to work when he wants. He's free. How in the world can you call somebody immersed in Torah observance a free person? Right? He's a great person, but the Chor is not free. How do you understand that? The rabbis tell us another fact. Ritzoneinu lasos ritzonecha. Every Jew, his neshama is screaming that he wants to do God's will. There is a portion of every neshama that can never be corrupted, never be tainted. It remains holy and pure all the time and is screaming, we want to do God's will. That's the inner will of every Jew, no matter who he is. Yair Lapid has that neshama, right, screaming that he wants to do Ratzon Hashem. So, umama akev, so why don't we? Right. Why don't we hear that inner will, that neshama? Two things are ma'akev. One is Seor Shebi'isa, the Yetzer Hara, and the second is Shibud Malchios, which simply means that sometimes we are prevented from our inner desires, and sometimes there are outside forces that prevent us from doing what we really want to do. Simply Goyim come and they prevent us from keeping the Torah. I think there's another idea of Shibud Malchios, not just coercion from outside forces, but a different kind of coercion. The Yetzer Hara, the Seor Shebi'isa, is an innate drives that people have, various appetites that people have that are normal. You're born with them, they're normal drives that HaKadosh Baruch Hu put in the world. The drive to eat is a drive for survival. A sexual drive is a drive for survival also, that there should be a propagation of the species. So God put these drives within us for a very, very good purpose. On the other hand, if you don't direct them and guide them properly, so they will lead you to bad things. That's the Yetzer Hara. Drives that uncontrolled will lead a person to evil, control can be very, very fine. That's why it says that you should serve God with both your hearts, both with the Yetzer HaTov and the Yetzer HaRa. Even those desires that unbridled are negative and related to the Yetzer HaRa can be directed and guided to be used for good purposes. That's Seor Shabi. So that's the chametz in the dough. Then there's another kind of Yetzer HaRa that is not innate. Person is not born with it. It's not a natural drive. Example, no person is born with a drive to buy faded, torn blue jeans that cost $300. It's not part of the psyche and the drives that a person is born with. Where does it come from? Shibud Malchios, cultural subjugation. It's a fad. And people are subjugated to fads. It's an outside, culturally induced kind of desire. That's called Shibud Malchios. So those two things prevent a person from listening to his inner will. Now, listening to that, now that inner will is not just a nice hashkothic idea, but it is a halachic idea based on the following. The Gemara says that in order to create a divorce, a get, one of the 10 conditions that the Torah gave for creating a get is it has to be given with the full volition of the husband. If the husband is forced to give the get, it's no get. There could be witnesses, it could be written perfectly, give it over to his wife, but if he is coerced into giving it, it's like he gave her a comic book. She's not divorced. However, there's an exception. The exception is situations where the person is required to divorce his wife, and we can force him to fulfill the mitzvah of divorcing her. For instance, a Kohen marries a divorcee. So the marriage is a marriage, but it's prohibited. She's not allowed to remain married to her. Okay? She needs a divorce, however. So we call Mr. Cohen, who just married a divorcee, into Beis Din, and in the time when Beis Din had this power, doesn't really apply today, and there's other means of forcing a person today, especially in Eretz Israel, but in any case, when the Beis Din had the power, we called Mr. Cohen into Beis Din, and we said, Mr. Cohen, we noticed in the newspaper, and mazel tov to you, that you just got married, and we found out that the woman is a divorcee, and you're not allowed to remain married to her, and we want you to divorce her. Mr. Cohen says, nothing doing. I love my wife and I'm not going to divorce her. He said, but it's a prohibited marriage. He said, I don't care. He said, okay, are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, grab him. They grab him, tie him to a post. They get a guy with a whip. They say, Mr. Cohen, you see this whip? If you don't divorce your wife, we're going to force you to do it. He says, I don't want to divorce my wife. Okay, beat him. They start beating him. Right? After a few good, sharp whippings, they ask him again, do you want to divorce your wife? No. Okay, beat him more. Now he's a bloody pulp, almost dead. They say, Mr. Cohen, you have a choice. We can continue beating you, and then your wife will not be married to you anymore because she will be a widow. Right? Or we can stop beating you, and you can divorce your wife. Maybe you change your mind. He says, you know what? I think I'd like to divorce my wife. So he said, fine. Tell the sofer to write the get. Tell the witnesses to sign. And he does that, they sign it, now give it over to your wife, he gives it to her, mazel tov, you're divorced. Who are we fooling? Right? This guy did not give the divorce willingly. He was forced into doing it. Right? And even though he said, I want, he meant, I want you to stop beating me. He didn't mean, I want to divorce my wife. So who are we fooling in making this a good get? Right? It's not true. Says the Rambam, based on the Gemara, when Mr. Cohen came into Beis Din, he really wanted to divorce his wife, because every Jew wants to do what's right. So his innate desire was there. What happened? Not that he didn't want to, he wanted to, but the Yetzer Hara superimposed other wills on top of that essence of what he really wanted, and muffled it, and didn't let it come to the surface. And therefore, when we beat him, we are not changing his will. we are releasing his will from being enslaved to other wills that are imposed on it. Because if we had to change his will, you can't change somebody's will by beating him. That's not his will. But if we're just releasing his will, then that's fine. We're taking away all the outside deterrence from his real desire to come to the surface. So we're not changing his will, we are releasing his will. Yeah.
So why not do that for every mitzvah? Just stop beating people because they really want to do it.
The truth is that that is the halacha. In a mitzvah saseh. When the Beis Din had the power, somebody says, I don't want to build a sukkah this year. I'm not interested in sukkahs. So we call them into Beis Din and we say, we understand that you're not building a sukkah. Are you invited to someone else's house? No. I just not interested in fulfilling the mitzvah of sukkah. Fine, beat him. Until he'll build that sukkah and sit in it, or he won't have to sit in a sukkah because people who are dead are not required to do mitzvahs. So that is really, right, and the idea being that we're not only concerned about him alone of doing that mitzvah, and we're not forcing him to do a mitzvah he doesn't want to do. We are releasing his inner will to do that mitzvah. And also, Klal Yisrael, everybody's responsible for everybody else, and if somebody doesn't fulfill the mitzvah of sukkah, it affects everybody. It's like spiritual pollution. So if a person says, look, I don't care if I release, gases into the ozone and cause people to get cancer. It's my underarm and I can do what I want with it, right? It's my deodorant can. No, you are causing pollution and causing havoc to who knows how many people are going to get cancer because of you. Assuming that that's the case, okay? But a lot of things that a person says is my own private business. It affects multitudes of people. Yeah.
So were they really good at methods of torture so they didn't kill the person?
Not really, just whipping.
Okay, fine.
But we don't have that power today, and don't worry. There were people who wanted to bring Mashiach faster or whatever, but they don't realize that when Mashiach comes, these things will become in force again. So they better be clear that they want Mashiach and they also want to behave as is befitting the time of Mashiach in any case. So therefore a person really who doesn't do what he really deep down knows what's good for him is basically a slave. I'll give you an example. It doesn't apply to me because I like those examples because they're not non-threatening to me. I don't smoke. Okay, I find it difficult to understand how anybody could smoke because it's really dangerous or whatever. But there are people who smoke. And I'm sure if you would get them in a lucid moment when they don't have a desire to smoke and ask them, do you really want to continue smoking knowing how dangerous it is? They would say, no, I would love to stop, except I can't. I'm really addicted to it and it's just so pleasurable I can't control myself. So imagine the little cigarette having legs and arms and a whip, right? And the cigarette saying, smoke me. And the guy really deep down is saying, I don't want to smoke you. So he's a slave to a cigarette. And that's the way with every Yetzer Hara. Because deep down, the person's neshama knows that he doesn't want to do this. But he's a slave to his Yetzer Hara, who is forcing him, basically, not forcing him, but pushing him to do what he really doesn't want to do deep down inside. And therefore the really free person is a person who is so immersed in Torah. Barasi Yetzer Hara, Barasi Torah Tavlin. The antidote to the Yetzer Hara is Torah. A person who is totally immersed in Torah and totally subjugated to God is a really free person. Because he's able to do what really deep down he wants to do. And not what the Yetzer Hara superimposes upon him. That's what it means. Ein lecha ben chorin ela mishosik b'Torah, at least in my estimation. And therefore, being a slave to God is the ultimate freedom. That explains something about the Seder. We start the Seder with a matzah. We introduce the matzah that this is the bread of affliction which our ancestors ate in Egypt. The Ibn Ezra says we didn't eat in Egypt. We left it, we ate it when we left Egypt post haste. So why does it say that we ate it in Egypt? He says because the matzah was also the food that the slaves ate for 210 years. The Egyptians fed us matzah. Why? Because it's economical. It's only flour and water, no additives. It has no labor factor because it's made very quickly. And it doesn't digest quickly, so you don't eat too much of it. It lays in your stomach. So that all of those things should add up for it to be a very economical food. And the Ibn Ezra says, in his time in Spain, that's what they fed prisoners, matzah. For those reasons, it's economical, cheap food. Today, something has changed. Today it's called lechem oni, because that's what you are after you buy it. But in any case, it's logically an economical food. So for 210 years, we ate matzah in Egypt as slave food. Now, it seems a little difficult to understand, therefore, the whole build and order of the Seder. We start the Seder with matzah to show that we started as slaves eating this matzah slave food. And then, what is the symbol of freedom? Again, in the end of the Seder, matzah. Why? Because we left Egypt post-haste and couldn't bake bread, we had to eat matzah. I mean, if I designed the Seder, I would do a little different. I would start with matzah, which is slave food, and I would end the Seder with 7-layer strawberry shortcake, and that is a sign of freedom. Right? You went from matzah to 7-layer cake. That's freedom. Why do we start with matzah and end with matzah? The answer is that we're still slaves. We're still eating slave food because we're still slaves. What happened was not that we went from slavery to freedom. We went from slavery to Paro to slavery to God. But slavery to God is the ultimate freedom. So we're still eating the food of slaves, except the master changed. In the beginning, we were slaves to Paro, which is slavery. In the end, we're slaves to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I didn't say that. The Gemara says it. The Gemara says, Mikara Avdi de Paro, the Gemara Megillah, the Hashta Avdi de HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Originally, we were slaves to Paro, and now we're slaves to God. So we continue eating slave food, but the difference is only who our master is. And that difference makes a difference between slavery and freedom. Okay. Now, so it comes out that real freedom is slavery to Hashem, meaning total subjugation to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay. Now we can understand the Parsha of Mishpatim. There are mitzvahs that are between man and God that are mostly chukim, right? Things that are super rational, beyond rationale. They're not irrational, but they're beyond rationale. And in those, it's natural to have to subjugate your mind to God because it's not something that you even think that you can rationalize. When it comes to mishpatim, it's a different story. Mishpatim are laws that seem to be rational. Right? So a person can keep them from a totally rational standpoint. Don't murder. Well, murder makes sense, right? People go around murdering each other. There can't be a society, right? Taking somebody's life isn't proper. That sounds rational. However, that's the black and white areas of murder. How about the gray areas of murder? Like euthanasia. Not young people in Asia, but mercy killing, right? Here you have a guy who's 119 and a half. He's suffering, right? And he tells you, please take me out of my misery. Just give me an overdose of my painkillers and let me die peacefully. Is that rational? No, right? I would say rationally. It sounds good to me. I think you should rationally maybe kill the guy. He wants to die. He's suffering terribly. How he's 119 and a half. He can't do anything, right? Are you allowed to do it? No, it's murder. How about abortion? Right? I wouldn't want to argue a pro-abortionist on radio, right, from a purely logical, rational standpoint. Because you can make a very nice case rationally. Oh, it's a woman's body, and it's not really a viable child, and is it murder? Yeah, it's not. You don't get the death penalty for it, but it's murder, according to some opinions at least. So is that rational? No. But that's what Torah says. So in mitzvahs between man and God, which for the most part are chukim. You can't even fool yourself into thinking that you can rationalize them and you understand them or whatever, and you'll follow your das. God said to eat matzah. God said to wave an esrog and lulav. Okay, so I'll do what God said. But in mishpatim, I could fool myself into thinking that I understand the reason, and therefore I can make the conditions and the parameters. There, right, where you can fool yourself into thinking that this is rational, right, you are subjugating your mind to God in a very, very extreme way when you accept the fact that God can tell you the parameters of mishpatim and not your own, not yourself. And that was a mistake the Goyim made when they, what's it called, when God offered them the Torah and they said what's in it. He told them the rational mitzvahs, the things that they were chayef to do anyway. Don't murder, don't steal. And they said, well, how can we accept that? Esav said, how can we accept the Torah that says don't murder? We have a bracha to live by the sword. And Yishmael said, how can we have a Torah that says don't steal? We have a bracha, our hands in everybody's pocket and theirs hands in our pocket. God left them. Why? Because even though they were required not to murder, but they accepted it according to their own understanding and rationale. They didn't subjugate themselves to God's understanding, and that's no Kabbalah Satorah. Kabbalah Satorah is Nasa V'Nishma. I totally subjugate my thinking to God's thinking. Let Him tell me what's rational or not. That's why even though the Mishpatim are rational mitzvahs, but it says that das balabatim is hepech midas haTorah. The das of people is sometimes the opposite of what the Torah's das is, even in mishpatim, in rational mitzvahs. You learn bava kama, bava metziah, bava basra, right? Many of the things go against what a person would think to begin with his own logic. So when a person subjugates his mind to the Torah, to the Rabbanu Shel Olam, when it's rational mitzvahs, that's the greatest sign that he's an Eved Lashem. Because subjugating it when it's beyond rational mitzvahs anyway, so you have no real choice. This is the real test. That's why Mishpatim is what's it called, the sign or the proof of real freedom. Are you really a slave to Hashem? Are you willing to subjugate your rational mind to God, not just your super rational mind? That's why Mishpatim is the culmination of Chavrus. You want to know what Geula is, redemption is? When you totally can subjugate yourself to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that only happens when you're able to subjugate your rational mind in the everyday things of this world. You want to subjugate yourself to God, you know, in spiritual things, okay, that's God's domain. But this is my domain, and I'll decide what the parameters are. You're only a free person when God decides what the parameters are in everyday life, in the physical things in the world, not just the spiritual things in the world. And God is the one who creates the standards and values, not you. And that's why the Sanhedrin, who basically were involved in civil law, and in formulating civil law and judging civil law, had to sit in the Beis HaMikdash opposite the Mizbeach. The Mizbeach represents sacrifice. Sacrificing your everything to Hashem, the Sanhedrin had to sacrifice their rational thinking to Hashem too, and think according to the guidelines that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave them, with the 13 principles of how to learn things from the Torah and whatever, and not decide that they can make these decisions and come to these conclusions on their own. So that's why the Sanhedrin had to sit opposite the Mizbeach, and that's why Parshas Mishpatim starts V'Ela, with a Vav, to connect it to Maimon Har Sinai. Just as much as the super-rational laws were given at Sinai, the rational laws were also given. The Rav, the Mevartanura, says this at the beginning of Pirkei Avos. Pirkei Avos deals basically with rational Musar that even the nations of the world have similar things. But you should know Moshe Kibel Torah Mi Sinai. Our mussar, our ethics, are not man-made. They are dictated by God. And they are no different than the super-rational religious laws. Ethics are the same thing. And if you don't understand that you have to subjugate your mind and your ethics and your standards and your values to Hashem, then you're not really an Eved Hashem and you're not really a free person. So real freedom starts with being redeemed physically and then receiving the Torah, but then applying the Torah and putting to every sphere of life. And that was the Mishkan. The Mishkan is bringing God down into this physical world, right? The purpose of the Mishkan was to be a Bayis Lashem, God's home, meaning that God is the one who creates the atmosphere, the environment, the standards, the values in this world. And everything that we have, we sacrifice to God. That's the second function of the Mishkan, sacrifice, where you take every physical thing on every plane, the animal, vegetable, mineral, and sacrifice it to God. And you go Aliyah Lerego every 3 times a year to be scrutinized to see if you're really God's slave or not, if you're really in God's army or not. So that was the purpose of the Mishkan. And until a person can put the Torah into every aspect of life and subjugate himself in every aspect of life and bring God's presence down into this physical world in the Mishkan, you're not really free. So the Sefer HaGeula, the culmination of redemption, is Sefer Shmos, including Mishpatim, and then putting it into practice through the Mishkan, Truma Tetzave, Kishisa VaYakov Pekude. That's why they are in Sefer HaGeula. And that's the connection to Parsha Shkolim. It says that, what are the purpose of the shekel? The shekel is money. Money, if anything, is the thing that gives a person power, prestige, right? Pleasure. That's money. That's why money is called kesef. Kesef comes from the Lashon kisufim, desires. Right? You can basically fulfill many of your desires through money. So what is the money given? The shekel is given for public sacrifices. That's the lesson of Shkolim. God said the Jewish people could be atoned for. With what? With a shekel. He said, that's what you're atoned for? With money? So yeah, he showed him a shekel of fire in the heavens. Because that is what the shekel is. If you will subjugate your money to sacrifice, meaning you sacrifice that and subjugate it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, whatever you can accomplish with that money, you subjugate it to God's will, that's the ultimate freedom of totally subjugating yourself to what the Rabban Shem wants, which is ultimately what you want. That is the idea. That's why Parshas Shkolim and Parshas Mishpatim many times coincide, because the lesson of the Shkolim, that it goes for sacrifices, the same lesson of Mishpatim that has to be opposite the Mizbeach, the Sanhedrin, right? That Mizbeach is a symbol of sacrifice, of subjugation to Hashem, taking everything in the world and using God as the standard, right? Not you telling God what you think he should do, but him telling you what he thinks you should do, and that is also the ultimate freedom. In my estimation, that's why Parshios Mishpatim till the end of Shmos are in Sefer Shmos and not in Sefer Vayikra, because they are the culmination of freedom. Okay, any questions on that? Okay, makes sense to you?